first got out of jury duty last year. I guess I didn't get out. We went around on a trip to South Dakota, and we came back, and I had a letter in the mail that said that I missed jury duty, and there was a misdemeanor out. And so I called down to the office, and they rescheduled me for, you know, 4 or 5 months later. And that morning, I went into the jury office, and I talked to the guy who I'd talked to a couple times before about trying to get out. And I said, you know, because I had emailed him the week before, somebody at work told me they got out of jury duty by letting them know that they're the breadwinner. And so through these emails, the guy said, sorry, you know, this is your civic duty. And so I went in that morning and I said, hey, you know, David, I'm the one who had been emailing you, and you know, what can we do about this? And he said, well, there's about 300 of you in here. There's a couple big cases going on, but most likely your name's not going to be called. And so, sure enough, I was called maybe number 10. And strange feeling, they called 50 of us. We all walked into the courtroom, Judge Leary's room, and sat us down, and Officer Yanez was sitting there. They interviewed us one at a time in front of the whole courtroom. And, you know, I thought then maybe now's the time to say something crazy to get out of this. And it's just different when you're asked to do something that's that serious. You know, normal people, we step up. And
Yeah.
So you end up on the jury, and the case starts. And it was actually a pretty quick case by a lot of the standards and measurements and predictions that people had about what it would be like. Before we go into the jury room, what do you remember from just sitting there during the testimony? And what do you remember feeling, or maybe talking to other jurors about?
The jurors, we never talked about anything.
During the arguments.
Yeah, about the case, of course. But it was a big shock. I mean, to watch the video, we had never seen it. It's never easy to watch. If you've seen it, it's never easy to watch. And it's one thing we asked to see again. And they called the whole court in, and they called us in. And we sat there and watched it as we watched it during the trial. And when we left there, I remember a juror saying, almost in tears, you know, that it never gets easier, because I think we watched it 4 or 5, maybe 6 times during the trial. And to watch it again while we were deliberating was just as hard, if not harder, because that was now the focus of, you know, of our deliberations. And
yeah.
And so.
So when you got in there, you're given the case, you know, what was the initial, I know you do some housekeeping stuff, you pick a foreman and things like that, but you know, how did it start off? What were the conversations around? Did you vote right away? I mean, what happened there in the room?
So there were 15 of us that sat through the whole case. And as the case went on and we saw the gravity of the situation, deep down, most of us were hoping that we would be one of the alternates. And so, you know, when they called the 3 alternates just before lunch on Friday, you could see that they were kind of, you know, that now they're invested, and you could see that they wanted to see it through. And the rest of us were kind of wishing we could trade places. And
yeah, because you're dismissed when you're the alternate there.
Yeah, they didn't even take him to lunch. And, you know, we walked around the corner with them, and they left. But, you know, of course we wanted to see it through, but at the same time, it was something we didn't want to have to decide on. And so when we got back into deliberation, you know, right away, somebody volunteered to be foreman. And, you know, that feeling, kind of there was that feeling of wanting to get away from it was there, and, you know, not really knowing how to handle it, because it was so trying on everybody.
And so you think everyone felt like that?
I don't think everybody did, but most of us did.
Yeah.
But when somebody volunteered to be foreman, it was just, yes, okay, mm-hmm. Go ahead. We need somebody to set this in motion. And so we did an initial vote, And it was pretty emotional. You know, it was kind of, people were just kind of saying how they felt, and it was pretty raw. And that happened through the end of Monday, happened nearly all day Tuesday, and we weren't really going anywhere. And then Wednesday morning, one of the jurors came in with just a great idea of, hey, well, you know, we're not going anywhere. Let's break this down and let's look at what the judge has asked us to do. And so we started breaking down. Slowly, we broke down the law and what we were asked to do. And, you know, that confirmed the jurors who were saying guilty. It confirmed what they were thinking, and it slowly took the emotion out of the other jurors. Mm-hmm. And that's what eventually led us to all come together on this.
Mm-hmm. That initial vote, I think we were talking before we were arranging this interview, I think you said the first vote was, do I have this right, 4 guilty and 8 not guilty in that very, very first vote. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
But then pretty quickly,
It was Tuesday that it changed for 10,
mm-hmm. 10 to
not
2.
Guilty and 2 guilty.
And that was on manslaughter, right?
That was manslaughter, and we all were unanimous. On Tuesday, we were all unanimous on the other two charges.
The firearm discharge charges.
Yeah, yeah. The endangerment charges, yeah. for the other two passengers.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's interesting to me. Uh-huh. That pretty early, it sounds like you had unanimous vote for not guilty on the weapons charges. And if you were on this side of the courtroom, which you weren't, you heard a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, or whatever the metaphor is that, well, maybe they'll do not guilty on manslaughter, but they'll get them on the weapons charge. Now, of course, we don't know anything out here, right? That's palace intrigue. But it is interesting to hear that the weapons charges became unanimous pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that had 100% to do with the photos from the coroner. And, you know, when you look at the video, you can see that Officer Yanez is taking the other two people, you know, and he's got them in his mind when he's directing where he's shooting. And to look at the photos, it really makes it clear that he was trying to avoid the other two passengers.
So just to say what you didn't say, what it sounds like the jury saw in those coroner or medical examiner photos was, I mean, bluntly, that he hit Philando enough that you could tell he was aiming properly?
He was aiming on his left side, on Philando's left
side. Oh, specifically on the left side, which was a bit away from Diamond Reynolds and away from the
child. Exactly, and he was also angling his firearm down. And, you know, yeah, it's strange to hear you say that perspective, because I haven't heard that.
I don't want to put words in your mouth either, so feel free to push back on me if I say
no. That's interesting, but that's one thing we agreed on pretty much immediately. And, you know, it's kind of, it was just brutal for us to think of, you know, these photos and somebody's life that was taken, and looking at his body in these photos as, you know, proof that he was taking somebody else's life into account. And he was in that sense.
Yeah. So you dispensed the last two charges relatively quickly, and then you had a few days of conversation on the manslaughter charge. And this is, I presume, where we had the moment of coming back and saying we're deadlocked, and the judge said go back.
Yeah.
What were those conversations? What were you back and forthing about?
You know, it's interesting, because to think of 12 people in a room that don't agree on something, and we were starting to feel the weight of the situation, and, you know, not pressure from anybody else, but pressure as the days went by, and seeing how this was lasting nearly as long as the trial, and maybe we weren't doing something right, but there were people that were on either side that felt like what they saw was convincing. And so there was no harsh words or no cross words between all of us. If we respected the other side, and it kind of turned into a war of attrition in a way where you were just trying to get out of there with what you had and not so much gain on the other side. And so, you know, I really respect everybody I sat with because nobody said anything hurtful or there was no attacking. It was very respectful. And so we did come to, at one point we were deadlocked and we wrote it, you know, to speak to the judge, you have to write a letter and then the guards take the letter to the judge and then the judge calls the court in and then calls us in and then addresses the question. And he looked at all of us and he simply said, let me read your instructions again and told us what our jobs were. And he, you know, released us to deliberation and we sat in the court maybe a minute. And the next day it was the same thing. It was, we were not going anywhere. And so, well, let's write another letter to the judge. And we all knew that he would let the deliberations go a while longer than the 3 or 4 days that we'd been sitting in there. And so, you know, every day, though, we thought we need to write a letter to the judge. Yeah. Let's let him know. But we realized that, you know, the same outcome would happen. And so,
what was the conversation? What did people talk about the dash cam video? Because now, since the verdict, we've all seen it. What did you talk about?
Just the violence of it. I guess a lot of us haven't seen a firearm being shot, and none of us had seen a human being shot, and all of the chaos around it. And, you know, we just talked about how it wasn't easy to watch, but it's not what we're here to get consumed by.
Oh, yeah. Say more about that.
Yeah, we were...
Because there's so much emotion about this video. You know this.
Yeah, so we were there to break down the law. And if we got wrapped up in the emotion of this, that this video brought out in us, then we just went nowhere. So we kind of put that aside and we didn't really talk about the video so much as to, we all had it kind of memorized at that point to say, well, this is what he said then, and this is what he said next, and this was the response. And, you know, so we all kind of had the video memorized. We kind of, you know, were trying to piece together, well, how long was it when he said this that he started firing? And so we were all going through in our heads about what we remembered, counting the seconds between his last statement and when he started firing. And we broke it down that way. And pretty soon we were not as wrapped up in the emotion of it as you would think.
I'm sure you've probably seen this, but that might actually be hard for some people to hear, that you tried to take the emotion out. And I understand why you're saying that. I think that actually is maybe a jury instruction or a principle. But, you know, you've heard so many people say, gosh, I watched that video and it was so jarring and so quick. I'm dumbfounded as to how that wasn't the slam dunk. But what I hear you say is, of course it was emotional, but we had to remove ourselves from that somehow. Did I capture that right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the very first day, the judge even warned us about what we were about to watch. And the very first time, it was just shocking. Yeah. I think, you know, we had these speakers that were facing us, and we all kind of gasped. You know, nobody had ever seen it, and nobody had ever seen anything like it. And it was the third and fourth time that we're not looking at what's happening anymore. We're looking at different things like where was Philando leaning? And like I said before, the seconds between shots and, you know, how it started so casual and polite between the both of them.
Right.
And, you know, sure, it ramped up really quick, but we were trying to figure out why.
You know, on the dash cam video, Yanez, in the moment, in those minutes after, told a fellow officer he didn't tell me where the gun was. The next day, he gave an interview with the state, the BCA, and said he thought he saw a gun. And then on the stand, he said he saw the handle of the gun. Did you talk about that? Did you find that to be consistent or not, the way those three statements came out in those three time spans?
Well, so the interview with the BCA was the next day after the incident.
Right.
And so we did talk about it, of course. That was a very large topic of our discussion. And what it boiled down to was he was under a tremendous amount of stress. He had just taken somebody's life. And so the fact that he might have said some things or not been so clear was completely dismissed by most jurors, rightfully so. He was maybe not in his right mind.
Right.
I mean, it was something none of us could imagine, taking another life. And so for us to speculate became futile.
Mm-hmm. This is a nuanced question, but do you feel like you were charged with deciding whether Officer Yanez acted properly or whether he screwed up or whether he did the right thing, or were you actually charged with something slightly different than those questions?
Well, at first, at first felt like we were being a bit too nitpicky with his actions as a police officer. And one of the things they told us we couldn't take into account was this hindsight 2020. And that's what a lot of us, some of us, kept doing. We kept saying an officer's training or what we would do in the situation. And, you know, and nobody really knows how a human is going to react. And
I think where I was going with that question was this difference between whether someone acted properly versus legally, right? The way the law is written, which may give deference to police, even if it wasn't the best thing to do or proper thing to do, it may still have been legal. Am I getting too nitpicky with that difference? or am I overthinking that? What do you think about that?
I think the law is always going to favor the police officer, and you know, it's it may be unfortunate in a lot of cases, but they're the ones that are out there dealing with volatile situations. And you know, one thing that we talked about was maybe he was overtrained a few weeks before. He had gone through training to kind of beat the reaction if somebody's going to pull a gun on you. And that was all part of his training. And so for a police officer to be right or wrong in their actions boils down to their training a lot of times. And you know, if there's anything that comes out of this, I think that's one thing that should really be looked at is an officer's training and how that's approached. And, you know, there's some other things like how a stop is made that a lot of us were thinking, you know, we went through some scenarios. Somebody was saying when you're in Alaska and you get pulled over and you have a firearm, you cross your arms at the steering wheel and that lets the officer know that do you have a firearm. Of course, if somebody's got a firearm and they don't want you to know, that's not going to help. But maybe just different ways of pulling people over. And maybe what's wrong with somebody coming back to the squad car or meeting halfway or, you know, there's so many things I think that could come out of this that people are not, rightfully so, not looking at right now because the emotion is so high.
Are you familiar with the concept of jury nullification?
I'm not.
It's an idea that says a jury and jurors can choose not to convict someone because they believe the charges themselves are unjust, or that the punishment is excessive. I mean, it's basically saying we don't agree with the premise, I guess, of the charges we're considering. And it's my understanding a tool juries can use if they know about it. So it sounds like that wasn't really a conversation.
It was not at all. Not a conversation. That's interesting because the discussion happened, you know, what if this was a lesser charge? And we didn't know what happened after manslaughter two, but my feeling was if it was something lesser, it could have gone further than a manslaughter two. You know, the fact of the matter was in that room, we didn't know what Officer Yanez saw. You know, if he had, you know, a video, the uniform videos that
the body cam
that they might start carrying. That if he had something like that, of course we would know better. But that's what we kept talking about. What if this and what if that? And then we would get off subject and somebody would bring us back. And
yeah. But I just to say what you said, are you saying that if there had been a different law in the books regarding manslaughter, which is the taking of another life, that maybe outlined when a police officer's actions were criminal? If there had been a different law on the books that's either directly look at, you know, when an officer should be guilty of manslaughter, maybe with a lesser punishment or whatever, that you might have actually wandered closer to conviction on that kind of a charge?
It would have gone further, but it would have gone further maybe with a few more. That was something I did hear. I did hear a juror say, if it was a lesser charge, then I would be more on this side. Hmm. So, you know, I think it would have gone further. I still don't think that he would have been convicted. You know, what we were looking at was some pretty obscure things to a lot of people, like culpable negligence.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, and so you think you might know what it means, and it's negligent, but maybe pretty bad negligence. Well, it's gross negligence with an element of recklessness. And that's something. So, okay, so then, well, what's negligence? Okay, we can kind of figure out what that is. And okay, well, gross negligence. Okay, well, then we had the law in front of us so we could break it down. And it just came down to us not being able to see what was going on in the car. And so some of us were saying that there was some recklessness there, but that didn't stick because we didn't know what escalated the situation. Was he really seeing a gun? And we all felt like he was a very honest guy in his life. And
Philando or the officer?
The officer. And so we felt like in the end, we had to go on his word. And that's what it came down to.
What changed on Friday? There were still the two votes for guilty. Was this a situation where, for lack of a better term, people just got wore down and it was Friday and we've been here a number of days, so let's just do this? Or do you think something changed in the way jurors thought about, you know, the law or the case that actually then made this moment of, oh, like a light bulb moment, almost like, oh no, okay, I get it. Now I'm not guilty.
What changed is that enough time had passed where the emotion was completely out of it. And it was broken down to the bare bones of the case. And also, I think 5 days is enough time for some things to sink in. And I think to grasp the law that we were talking about, it took a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it had anything to do with the weekend. I think 5 days is a period of time that you could really boil it down to what we were actually talking about, and was beyond a reasonable doubt something that we could say he was proven guilty of, that kind of started to become clear, and it wasn't enough. We had to take this guy for his word, and we had to take him as being innocent. And
innocent till proven guilty. That's the thing. They're innocent till you're proven guilty.
Exactly.
That's the whole foundation.
And we couldn't say that he was guilty. Like I said before, it was all about not being able to see what was happening.
Yeah.
You know, then, you know, I think the state did a very good job, and the where they fell a little bit short was not being able to prove that he saw or didn't see the gun.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the line was drawn, and that's where
we
made our decision.
We're talking this hour with one of the jurors from the Officer Yanez case. We're not naming his name or which side he was on during the week there, although the entire jury ended up at not guilty for fear of retribution and the like. And as we're talking this hour, you went into the courtroom, and then we had Friday, right? And here's the verdict. And one of my colleagues who was there noted that Philando Castile's mother immediately stood up, even though the judge had said, please stay in your seats, and yelled,
yeah,
and walked out. Then you guys were taken back outside the courtroom, but, you know, back towards the jury room. Did you talk at all as a jury after the verdict was out, after that had been said in court, after that wave of first reaction was out? What did you all talk about in that moment?
Yeah, I didn't know that was his mom, but it makes sense. I mean, yeah, so when the verdict was read, we were standing already, and the judge sent us back to the jury room, and they locked the door like they always did when we got in there for deliberation, and nobody said a word. We sat there with our thoughts to ourselves, and it must have been 4 or 5 minutes, not a sound, until one of the older jurors, this just a guy who had these stories that would lighten up. You know, when we'd be on break, he'd tell us these stories that were just hilarious but also meaningful, you know, and it would kind of change our moods mm-hmm. from these deliberations. And he finally said something, and he said, I wish they knew how hard it was for us too. And, you know, it was not something that we took lightly. It was not something that was easy by any means. And I can't speak for all the jurors for most things, but I can in saying that what happened to Philando is not okay with any of us. You know, nobody felt good about any part of this. And we were just asked to do a job, and we did it. And I think every one of us is proud of how we acted, but nobody felt good. Nobody was okay with it.
Yeah. For people who saw the not guilty verdict and drew the conclusion that means you, the jury, believe that Officer Yanez did everything right, what would you say to them?
I would say exactly that is not how we all felt in there. We felt sure there are things he could have done differently. But in that moment, when things escalate, and who knows how it happened, but we knew that there were different things based on his training and based on the stop that could have been done differently. But again, that's the hindsight 2020.
Yeah.
And people react differently. And, you know, there was a lot of stress around that stop to begin with. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that we walked away saying he did exactly the right thing, because sure, there are things that could have been done differently.
Yeah. What about for people who are relieved or even happy or think you guys did great job? What would you say to them?
I would say nobody's happy about this, and it wasn't something that anybody in there completely jumped on board with. It was, you know, there were those that thought, you know, they sided with the officer from the beginning and felt like he reacted appropriately. But I don't want anybody to think that we did a great job in there. I mean, it was what we had to do, and it was not something that anybody just jumped to lightly. Mm-hmm. I don't know how really to answer that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you're saying, if you're relieved, fine, but hold your horses. We didn't enjoy what happened that week.
That's why I like you, Tom. You got a good way of putting words together.
What are your thoughts on overall the reaction you've seen in the last week? Just what are your thoughts?
You know, I think if anybody's handling this the right way, it would be Philando's mom. I think if you want to make a change, you can't go after a jury or a police officer. I think you need to go after the law. I don't know what that means. I've been thinking about it this week. I don't know how you go about doing that. Do you run for city council? I feel like Obama said it best when he was leaving office. I mean, just get involved. I don't know if that means contacting your representative or your congressman or picking up a book and going to law school. I don't know how you do it, but I think people should figure out a way to make a difference. They should get involved and go after the law. Don't go after people. I mean, there are some situations where people are clearly guilty, and then yes, but in situations like this, it's the law. It's the law that people need to go after.
What did you learn through this process?
So in the middle of the week, we were hopelessly deadlocked, and one of the jurors had a birthday, and so we brought in a little crown from Burger King, and, you know, somebody gave her some M&Ms, and somebody brought her some tea that they picked up in Scotland, and we sang happy birthday to her at the end of the day. And everybody was, up until that point, in disagreement. Not everybody, but we, as a whole, were not together on this verdict. And we still put that aside, and we sang her happy birthday. And, you know, I've got a few phone numbers out of this, and I hope to have some lifelong friends, because you could only hope to have a better group of people. I've just learned that people will step up when they're asked, and they'll do the right thing. I feel like we did the right thing, even though it's caused a lot of hurt.
And then you told me you got home and there was a alert in your mail because of a glitch in the computers that you were under arrest for missing jury duty.
Yeah, I had a letter in the mail that said, like the letter I had a year ago, that there was going to be a misdemeanor out because I missed jury duty. I opened it up and I kind of showed my girlfriend, and she looked at me like, boy, this is a big one to make up here. So
that's been cleared up. We should clarify. You're not under arrest anymore. You're not. There's no misdemeanor. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.